Subcommittee on Natural Resources of the Joint Ways and Means Committee for Tuesday, January 23rd, 2007. We have three items on the agenda: the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Environmental Quality, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Because we have three items and they're relatively complex agencies, but we only have an hour and a half to do them, each presenter will have about 20 minutes to present their agency and about 5 to 7 minutes for questions. They should still keep their speed of delivery normal. So with that, we will start off with Ms. Koba from the Director of the Department of Agriculture. Paul, did you have anything you want us to put on?
Mr. Chair, no.
Thank you and good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and with me is Lisa Hansen, who is our Deputy Director, and then Satish Okagwe with Budget Management. And you have a document in front of you that we're going to go through so I can get through the agency in 20 minutes. And I will do the best I can to make this make sense for you, but I think I need to start out by saying that for our agency, we're probably the most diverse of the natural resources agencies, and so it's a struggle for us to try to get you information in a form that you can keep all together. So if you've got this packet in front of you, I'm going to walk through that and start with page 2, which is our mission statement, threefold mission statement. Number 1, we promote the economic vitality of the industry. Number 2, we protect and enhance the natural resources base for the industry. And 3rd, we provide consumer safety and protection with our food safety programs and our weights and measures program. The objectives for the department are to, first of all, help the industry succeed economically. Secondly, help the industry succeed environmentally. 3rd, respond to plant and animal pests, diseases, and other threats. And 4th, ensure safe food and protect Oregon's consumers. On page 4 is a snapshot of our organization structure. And I will mention that the department has right at 350 full-time equivalent positions when you take into account the number of seasonal positions that we bring on for the variety of things that we do. We bump up to about 575 positions. On the next page, the pie chart was, this pie chart and the next one, we're trying to get you a framework of our agency. We have three primary policy areas. First of all, the agricultural marketing and development policy area. Then secondly, our natural resources policy area. And 3rd, our food safety and consumer protection policy area. So our budget structure is in these three policy areas. And then we have divisions which fall underneath those policy areas. So this morning I'm going to go through policy area, the divisions within that policy area, and then to the next policy area. And then the next pie chart, you can see the actual divisions within the agency. Our natural resource, our plant division is our single largest division by budget expenditures, followed by natural resources division. Then we have pesticides, commodity inspection, food safety, measurement standards, animal health and identification, ag development and marketing is our smallest division by budget. On page 7, for me, is probably one of the most important slides I'll go through today for you. These are the highlights of basically what our past 2 years have looked like and kind of the key issues that the director's office and our Board of Agriculture have been dealing with. First of all, I personally, as well as many of the staff and the board, spent a lot of time on public education about agriculture and the contribution that agriculture makes to Oregon's economy and to its environment. We spent a lot of time on market access and international trade issues, not only our own trade work that we do with Oregon producers and processors and the multiple markets that we are involved in, but we stay at least abreast of what's going on in terms of WTO discussions and the Doha round because it certainly impacts our industry here in Oregon. And we're also very, very excited, frankly, about kind of the focus now and the interest on buy local and the opportunities for Oregon agriculture and that connection between agriculture and our urban consumers and through farmers markets, farmer chef collaboratives, things like that are very exciting for us here locally in the state. We've been spending a lot of time around sustainable certification programs and really what we're seeing in the marketplace. And Representative Nolan, you've got a handout in front of you, and I'm on page 7 if you want to catch up. Kind of a driving issue that we're seeing in the market right now is this notion of certification, particularly around sustainable products. And whenever I talk about this, the first question I get is, well, what is sustainable? And the answer is, it depends. But we are keeping our eyes on these certification programs because we're seeing a proliferation of them, and we think, number one, they're great opportunities for the industry, but we also think there's a very important role that the department needs to play in terms of helping the industry kind of navigate through this maze. Probably the most well-known certification program is the organic certification program, whereby there are a set of federal standards that are set up that producers have to meet in order to be certified organic. But in terms of a sustainable certification program, probably the most well-known one in Oregon is the Food Alliance program, which is a private organization that sets up a realm of standards, and if producers or processors meet and are certified to those standards, then they become Food Alliance certified. But there are a myriad of certification programs, and again, I think an area where we will be spending some time as we work through our budget with you. Renewable energy, we can't say enough about that. Incredible opportunities for the industry as well as some interesting challenges, and we've been working hand in hand with all the other agencies and industry folks on renewable energy issues. Land use is a big deal, obviously, for our industry, and as we continue to work through Measure 37, dealing with the right to farm and nuisance complaints that we get from folks, and we continue to monitor what's going on with the Big Look Task Force. Air quality is a fairly new issue that's come onto our horizon, and we do have a piece of legislation in front of this body talking about agriculture and air quality issues. Field burning has always been a topic, which is also on people's radar screens, but we're seeing more and more interest in air quality, particularly around dairies, and that's an issue that we're engaged in. Water quantity and availability, I think you've all heard about this. Number of great opportunities, I think, for the industry, but the key message I would deliver is water quantity is critical for agriculture. And as we look around the state and the concerns around shortage of water for every use, it will significantly impact agriculture if we cannot get ahead of this issue and figure out some creative ways to make more water available for all industries, including agriculture. We're watching very closely the 2007 Farm Bill. It has huge implications for agriculture in this state, whether it's around conservation programs, marketing programs, renewable energy, and commodity price support. Agricultural labor, another topic that we've heard a lot about, collective bargaining, minimum wage, but I think the toughest issue for the industry this past summer, and the one that I worry about most coming up, is availability of labor. We had crops that were not picked because producers could not get labor, and that is something that could have a significant impact on the industry if we can't have labor available for harvest. Homeland security issues have been ongoing. We are very involved in terms of preparing against terrorist acts on food, animal, what have you. We've been very involved as well with supervised price negotiations for grass seed and seafood, which have been a learning experience, I think, for all of us, have not been easy issues to deal with. We were the agency that distributed salmon assistance money to the industry, which also turned out to be quite an interesting endeavor for us. And then finally, I just need to bring note the whole topic of invasive species, whether it's pests, disease, weeds, what have you. As we see more and more of global trade, global interaction, this is a topic for the industry that is going to be ongoing, how we keep the pests and disease that are a threat to our industry out of this state. So let's move into the economic development policy area. And the first division is the Ag Development and Marketing Division. This is Paul's favorite subject in our agency. And in our Ag Development and Marketing Division, we do a lot of market work, linking products to market. We don't buy and sell within our agency, but we bring the buyers and sellers together, whether at a local level, at a domestic level, or an international level. We also spend a lot of time working on opportunities to add value to products that are grown in this state. For Oregon agriculture, that's absolutely critical in order to compete in a global environment. We can't do it commodity by commodity. We just cannot compete at a cost level. So every opportunity we have to add value, whether it's food processing, packaging, labeling. Harry and David is a great example, putting a pear in a nice fluffy piece of paper and charging two or three times what you would for just a pear off the tree. And as I've mentioned, direct marketing, farmers markets, farmer chef collaboratives, roadside stands, and then working with the industry to access resources that are available for them to approach markets. In the ag development and marketing area, our key issues, I've mentioned again, globalization of trade. It really touches all of what we do in this agency, but we are just not competing with Idaho or Washington in terms of moving product to market. We are competing with China or Mexico, and all of those issues that go around differentiating your product and getting your product in the marketplace. For Oregon, the importance of export markets. We're thrilled about the interest in buying local, but the fact of the matter is 40% of what we produce in Oregon moves into an international market. So we cannot in this state consume everything that we produce, and we have got to continue to maintain our outside of Oregon markets, our domestic markets, as well as our export markets. Along with buying local, there's a huge interest in healthy foods, nutrition, concerns around obesity, and again, I think some great opportunities for Oregon agriculture to tap into those interests with our food products, and as I've mentioned, certification programs proliferating domestically and internationally. We work a lot with the industry, particularly with processors, on issues that they face in terms of wastewater treatment costs, a big deal, particularly in the Valley or in the Medford area for some of our food processors. Transportation is another huge issue both for producers and processors. Transportation costs, fuel costs have had a big impact on our industry. And then industry diversity, over 250 products produced in the state, poses a challenge for us as we try to serve the diversity of agriculture in Oregon. Let me take a breath for a minute, see if there's any questions about ag development before we move on to commodity inspection.
We'll wait until the end of your presentation.
Perfect. The next slide I just wanted to bring to your attention, we're going to go into our commodity inspection division now, which is the division that has the expertise to actually conduct certifications. And we certify for good agricultural practices and good handling practices on the farm, through the warehouse. But this also becomes a marketing tool for us. And the first picture that you see on the left-hand side, it's Oregon Berry Packing, and they have the Good Agricultural Practices Certificate. Then you'll see a picture of the family, and this is a picture poster that was actually on display with their blueberries in Japan. And the interesting little tidbit about this picture is blueberries are considered very healthy and very good for your eyesight. Well, Roy Malinsky, who is the owner of Oregon Berry Packing, and on the left, wears glasses. So for the picture, they had him take off his glasses for marketing blueberries in Japan. Our commodity inspection program does provide our inspections and quality assurance for products moving into the market. Traditionally, onions and potatoes are all inspected by our inspectors for official sampling and grading. And then our program has also moved, as I've said, into the certification realm, and we do conduct certification for good agricultural practices, good handling practices. This is a fee-for-service thing that we offer. We do seed regulatory programs for grass seed and other seeds in the state, and then inspect hops, hay, and straw, again, on a fee-for-service basis. Anything else you want to add, Lisa?
Many of the programs in commodity inspection are voluntary fee-for-service programs. So these are at the request of the industry to meet certain market needs.
it is fully an other funds funded program. Key issues in this area, this whole demand for alternative inspection services that are audit-based. No longer can we or the industry afford to inspect every single apple as it moves on the line. So it really becomes more of a impetus upon the producer, the packer, to set up processes that ensure the quality, and then we find ourselves in the role of coming in and auditing those practices more than being on the line constantly. Again, it's a cost issue. And then I've mentioned many of the certification programs. Challenge for us is maintaining an adequate pool of qualified inspectors. We've been pretty innovative in our Ontario area. We are using prison labor in our inspection program, and it's been very successful. And then again, along with certification, increased demand for traceability and identity preserve programs that meet market requirements. We will actually provide a program where we put a seal on a product that moves into the truck, seals the truck, and so that then the person on the other end that receives the product knows that that identity for that product has been preserved through the chain, and we can trace it back to the farm. Our next policy area, so we're moving out of the economic development policy area into our food safety and consumer protection policy area. And our first division in that policy area is our food safety division. And this is a program where we have inspectors and sanitarians who are licensed to inspect all aspects of the food processing and distribution system through the grocery store. The only inspections we do not do are restaurants, and those are done by health. But we are coordinated in terms of how we approach those inspections so that restaurants are meeting the same standards and kind of inspection protocol that we conduct when we do our inspections for food safety. And as we know, it's been a huge hot topic in the news lately, the whole issue around food and food safety issues, whether it's E. coli in beef or more recently E. coli in spinach in California. So a lot of interesting challenges as we continue to deal with providing a safe food product for consumers. The key issues in this area, certainly within Oregon, cultural diversity poses some challenges for us. There are segments, as an example, there are segments of the population who believe very strongly in having access to raw milk. That's a food safety issue. Consuming raw milk, unpasteurized cheese is another area where we have ethnic groups that like to make cheese in their bathtubs. And this can be a food safety issue. So it's not just going to kind of the standard operations that you would consider, but trying to get at all aspects of food that may reach a consumer and making sure that food is safe. I mentioned already the what we seem to be as seeing as increasing outbreaks in terms of food safety illness. I'm not sure that that's actually true. I think there's certainly been some high-profile outbreaks. Just the complexity of our inspections and integrated operations, the fact that here as well we are changing our inspection protocols and really keying in on those factors that have the most potential to provide a food safety concern, temperature probably being number one. If producers and processors through the food chain keep cold things cold and hot things hot, it can avert a lot of food safety concerns, but that doesn't always happen. We are challenged more and more by the diversity of farmers' markets and how to approach them in terms of food safety issues. It's no longer just fresh fruits and vegetables that are provided at farmers' markets, but we're seeing more actual cooking done there, and that's an area that we've been working with the farmers' markets to figure out how best to provide food safety issues. And then homeland security issues, a big issue here. Moving on, well, I better speed up, our animal health and identification division. This is where we deal with livestock diseases, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or mad cow disease, which was the huge outbreak that we dealt with some time ago. But we're also paying attention to West Nile virus, avian influenza, and all of those other things. And then the other component of our livestock health and ID program is the ID program, the brands program, which ensures that cattle moving or other livestock moving, that they're not stolen cattle, but they actually are rightfully belonging to the owner and sold to the owner. Key issues here, animal diseases, just like pests and insects, will continue to be a big issue that we as a society deal with. And then the whole national identification program and how we're trying to register premises and move through that has been a challenge, I think, for the industry. Country of origin labeling is another thing that's been a challenge for this industry to try to get its hands around. The third division in our food safety and consumer protection policy areas, our measurement standards division. This is a division that a lot of people don't realize we have in our agency, but that we ensure all scales in the state are indeed accurate, and we do motor fuel quality, and we will be talking about this issue as we deal with biofuels and some of the motor fuel quality challenges that we have around biofuels. Also in this division is our packaged product labeling and transaction verification program, and this is dealing with products that you would find in a grocery store. You buy a pound of hamburger to make sure it actually is a pound, that the store has dealt with the tear issue, which is the little padded thing that comes in the hamburger and soaks up weight, and you need to adjust the weight for that. So we've got a program that does spot checking on those issues. We also make sure that the ping pong balls used in the lottery drawings are all equal. In terms of key issues, we will be bringing forward a fee increase for this program. It's another funded program, and we need to increase fees in order to continue the program. Just the increase in the complexity of devices for weighing and measuring makes us stay on our toes to deal with those. And then, as I mentioned, the whole infrastructure aspect of delivering biofuels is a new area and a new challenge for us. Our laboratory services division actually serves all the divisions in our agency. We do our food and dairy food sample testing, we do our pesticide and fertilizer lab analysis, shellfish, market assurance testing. We have a really top-notch laboratory capability, and it's very, very important for us to maintain that expertise in our agency. Finally, our third policy area, our natural resources policy area. And the first division in there is our Natural Resources Division. This is where we do our Senate Bill 1010 water quality program, our confined animal feeding operation program, so dairies, feedlots, making sure manure stays where it should be and not going where it shouldn't be, our soil and water conservation districts, and a lot of the resource that we use, we rely on those districts to do on-the-ground projects and dealing with water quality issues and salmon restoration, our smoke management program, which is our field burning program, shellfish plat leasing and land use. Key issues, continuing staying on top of all the things that come with dealing with confined animal feeding operations and how you manage manure. Continuing our implementation of Senate Bill 1010 and maintaining a capacity in our soil and water districts as they deliver services on the ground. Our plant division, as I mentioned, is our largest division, dealing with invasive pests, weeds and diseases. Probably the longest known pest that we keep a close eye on is the gypsy moth. We also do regular trapping for Japanese beetle, cereal leaf beetle. We found an Asian gypsy moth last summer, which is not a good thing. We don't like them, and we don't want them in Oregon. On the disease side, the most challenging issue we've faced recently is sudden oak death, Phytophthora ramorum, which can occur in the wild and attacks oak trees, but also can get into the nursery industry and would be devastating if it became established in Oregon. We do nursery and Christmas tree inspections for all product that leaves the state. We have our weed control program, whereby we work to control weeds in the state and ideally keep weeds out. But once they are here, we work to try to control them as well as provide grants to local entities that also do on-the-ground weed control projects. We have the Threatened and Endangered Plant Program, so plant species program that deals with threatened and endangered plants on public lands only. And we are a member of the Invasive Species Council. The big issue in plant, as I've mentioned before, is, again, just the whole issue of pests, weeds, and diseases, trying to keep them out of our state. And if they do get here, trying to be aggressive and eradicating them before they take a substantial foothold. We'll leave the canola discussion for another day. How's that? Third division in this area is our pesticides division. This is the division that does all of the licensing, monitoring, product registration, and investigations and enforcement for pesticide use in the state. We also have the fertilizer program, which does product content and labeling for fertilizers to make sure that what is on the label actually is what's in the product. And then we have our pesticide use reporting system, which I'm happy to report is up and running as of January 1st.
Thank you.
You are welcome. And the PARC program, which is the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, which is a multi-agency entity that deals with issues of concern around potential pesticide-related illnesses. We refer those kinds of things to PARC, which contains DEQ, Health, ourselves, a number of agencies, to conduct those investigations. And it's a very, very useful tool to deal with objective look at what could be pesticide-related illnesses or prove to not be the case. In our pesticides division, again, we will be bringing forward a fee bill. We need to raise fees in this program to continue the program. The whole challenge around EPA product registration and labeling actions and where pesticides can and cannot be used and getting that information out to the industry so they can comply. For our state, the number of specialty crops that we have, pesticides aren't often registered for specialty crops, and so we have to go through a special registration program in order to do that. And then just ongoing education and outreach, both for PERS, but as well as for our regular users to make sure they are in compliance and doing the things they should be doing and not what they shouldn't be doing. And then finally, our administration and business services does what every administration and business services office does. Payroll, human services, everything like that. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm done.
Thank you, Ms.
I'm sorry I couldn't keep it to 20 minutes.
We have about 4 to 5 minutes for questions. Anyone has any questions? I do have a request, Ms. Cola. When you come back, we'll have several days, and there'll be a number of issues probably to go over in each one of these divisions. And this is an area where I don't really think it would be fair to say if something's going badly that it's all due to the Department of Agriculture. Or if it's going well, it's all due, because I know it's going neither, actually. Could you give us some kind of an overview of in a sense, the sense of agriculture in the state, in the terms of markets, in the terms of are we getting better or are we getting worse? Are we getting, less profitable, more profitable? I realize we can't control world markets and we can't do all of that, but are some of our efforts in terms of, particularly in terms of marketing organ products, are they showing some success?
Be happy to. We are actually, you will be receiving soon, Mr. Chair, as will all members of the legislature, our first biennial report on the state of the industry. And this was a charge that was given to the Board of Agriculture when they were reconstituted during the last legislative session to become a policymaking board. And it's a report that's chock full of information, but we will pull out highlights from that report to present to you. I can tell you generally very good news about the industry. They are doing very well. It continues to grow. We do well in our markets. We always have segments of the industry that struggle. Wheat has been in that boat for quite some time, but recently wheat prices are up. So for Senator Nelson, it's good news. He's got a smile on his face for the first time in 10 years.
My banker's happy.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the number of acres, number of acres of wheat, number of acres of alfalfa, I know you have that information. I was always operating on the assumption there was like 4 million acres of actual cultivated ground, but then I heard someplace there's 17 million.
17 off the top, Brent, I know, knows this by heart.
17 in ag years, and they're about 4.5.
4.5 million ago. So there's
sure.
I'd heard those two different figures, and I wasn't quite sure if 4 million or 17 million.
So the 17 million would include grazing lands,
pasture.
Okay, so there's 4 million acres, and is there a breakdown as to wheat, alfalfa?
We can get that
can
for
get
you.
That? Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just really quickly, Katie, last session in this committee, you had talked about the concern regarding lack of funding for adequate inspectors. And I know you had mentioned it here. I haven't had a chance to look through the whole budget, so if you can give us an update on that. And certainly with the increase in population, and then I'm assuming that with the greater demands of the farmers markets, too, I know they're growing all over the state, and your inspectors are responsible for working with that program. So if you can give us an update on the food inspection program.
We'll be happy to do that. The food safety program did come in for a fee increase last session, which was approved, as was additional general fund dollars put back into that program, which had experienced cuts of general fund. So in food safety, I would say we're in good shape. We'll give you more information. But we have three programs that will require fee increases to continue their current level. Our measurement standards program, our pesticides program, and
our brand inspection
program. So you will be seeing those through the budget process.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to sort of flag something that I want to be involved with, at least with you, and that's the issue of kind of the in your ag marketing and development and talking about value added, because I know how critical that theory is, but I also know the reality, which is a lot of us who are involved in it. You know, I grow the state pear, 1.5 million pounds, can't farm. You know, like you say, I can't do a farmer's market on that much. But, you know, we're getting like 12 cents a pound some years, 15 cents a pound. You're paying $1.49. We're not getting hardly any of it. And there are reasons for that, you know, that are beyond us, vertical integration, all kinds of things outside our control. But what I found is due to the need for off-farm income for a lot of younger growers, myself included, my wife, a lot of our friends, it's hard to get into value-added brainstorm mode when you're just trying to survive, and that's where I feel like some of the solutions come from. You know, this is bringing a new middleman into the equation, but bringing people who are good at marketing, people who are good at this kind of thing. And I just had too many conversations with growers who have really successful fruit stands. They drive into Portland, and he'll be driving back and call and say, you know, I missed all my kids' games, though, just to do this, and I can't do this that much longer. So figuring out, I mean, that's the problem, figuring the solutions where, you know, you have entities in Portland who are really good at the creative aspect and they know how to sell things. Let the growers, you know, be the growers, and let my father-in-law would call them the peddlers, be the peddlers, and figure out, you know, how everybody can make money in the meantime. Because it's great to talk about value added. It's very difficult to do it when you only have so many hours in the day and you've been working harvest the whole time. You can't just go do a fruit stand without that coming at the expense of something.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Clem, we can give you a little bit of an overview of kind of the structure of the industry, and it is kind of that middle grower that is struggling the most in Oregon, mid-sized.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda is the Department of Environmental Quality, Ms. Hallett. You'll have about 21 minutes, 22 minutes to present.
No problem, Mr. Chairman.
And about 5 minutes for questions.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck. I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and with me is Lisa Pearson from Budget and Management. The packets are being handed out. What I'm going to talk about first is our mission, authority, and operating structure. We were formed in 1969 for the specific purpose of cleaning up the Willamette River, and today our broad mission is to be a leader in restoring, maintaining, and enhancing the quality of Oregon's air, water, and land. DEQ serves all citizens of Oregon from offices throughout the state, and you can see those offices on the right-hand side of your packet. The first handout is a map of our three regions and all of the offices. We are a decentralized agency. We protect the environment and public health through state and federal regulations. We are authorized by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to operate federal programs under the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Acts. We also administer state environmental programs enacted by our legislature, including the Opportunity to Recycle Act, the Groundwater Protection Act, the Toxic Use Reduction Program, and the State Environmental Cleanup Law. DEQ is governed by a 5-member Environmental Quality Commission. They are volunteers appointed by the governor, subject to confirmation by the Senate, and the second handout in your packet shows the members. Lynn Hampton is the current chair, and Bill Blosser is the vice chair. All rules administered by the department must be adopted by the commission. The DEQ director has no independent rulemaking authority. On the left-hand side of your packet is a little color brochure. That is our 2006 to 2011 strategic directions. The agency and the commission recently completed an update of those. Our overarching priority at the agency that you will see in that little brochure is to deliver excellence in everything that we do. Our specific priorities are to promote sustainable practices, improve Oregon's air and water, protect people and the environment from toxics, and to involve Oregonians in solving environmental problems. We achieve these priorities and others using a variety of tools: rulemaking, permitting, monitoring, financial and technical assistance, education, and enforcement. I neglected to mention my talking points are also in the brochure. You can follow, in the pocket with the brochure. You may follow along with me, should you choose. We also work with multiple partners, advisory committees, local governments, EPA and other federal agencies, state agencies, universities, tribal representatives, businesses, environmental groups, and citizens. I'm now going to move to discuss DEQ's program elements, successes, and challenges, and I'm going to refer to the org charts that are stapled together in your packet. The goal of our work is to protect Oregon's environment and the health of our citizens. We currently have about 777 employees in 8 divisions. That is the first environmental chart in the staple together packet. And that shows our hierarchical structure and our 8 divisions. Our management structure is a matrix. We have employees in the air, water, and land programs located in our central headquarters, our laboratory, and in our regional offices, which were shown on the map in the first handout. We also operate 6 vehicle inspection stations in Portland and 1 in Medford. I'm going to touch briefly on key program elements, successes, and challenges for each of the 3 programs, air, water, and land. The second organizational chart in the stapled package is air. We monitor air quality across Oregon to ensure that Oregonians are breathing air that meets or is better than national air quality standards. We regulate some 1,200 sources of industrial air pollution through permits. We inspect approximately 1.1 million vehicles in the Portland metro area and the Rogue Valley. We respond to more than 3,000 air quality complaints during a biennium, and we ensure that asbestos is properly removed and disposed of. We have made tremendous progress in improving air quality. During the 1970s and the 1980s, Oregon routinely violated federal standards for particulate, which is smoke and dust, ozone, or commonly referred to as smog, and carbon monoxide. Oregon's air now consistently meets or is better than federal standards for these pollutants, as reflected in Oregon benchmark number 75, percent of time air is healthy to breathe for Oregonians, which presently is 100%. We do face future challenges, however, from population growth, tightened federal standards for particulate matter, toxic air pollutants, and greenhouse gas emissions. We must also protect the visibility of our scenic vistas and special places like Crater Lake and the Columbia River Gorge. Moving now to water quality, which is the third in the stapled packet of org charts. Oregon has over 100,000 miles of rivers, over 6,200 lakes, 9 major estuaries, 1.25 million acres of wetlands, and over 360 coastal miles. There are over 200,000 groundwater wells installed for drinking water. Several state agencies play a role in protecting Oregon's water. You heard the Department of Agriculture mention that this morning. Water Resources Department regulates water quantity. Health and Human Services protects drinking water. State Lands has jurisdiction over wetlands, and DEQ protects water quality, and as you heard, in partnership with the Department of Ag. We set and enforce water quality standards and monitor water quality in 19 river basins. We also designate groundwater management areas where groundwater quality is at risk. We issue more than 4,500 permits to regulate waste discharges from city sewage treatment plants and industrial facilities. We work with many partners to reduce pollution carried by stormwater runoff from urban areas, agriculture, forest practices, and construction. We also provide loans to local governments for sewage treatment systems and share responsibility with counties for regulating septic systems. Long-term statewide ambient river monitoring, as reflected in Oregon Benchmark 78, shows that after 14 years of steady improvement, water quality is currently holding steady at the 144 monitoring sites in DEQ's ambient network. 14% of sites have improving trends and 14% have decreasing trends in water quality. As in air quality, a future challenge to protecting Oregon's water comes from toxic chemicals that enter water from the air and land or exist because of legacy mining and industrial past practices. We must also figure out how to control pollution from pharmaceuticals and dental amalgam and to further reduce pollution from rural and urban runoff. And moving now to land quality, which is the fourth organizational chart in the stapled packet. There are five land quality programs that are focused on reducing, safely managing, and cleaning up waste and toxic chemicals. The solid waste program regulates landfills and transfer stations through permits and emphasizes reduction in the use of toxic substances, prevention and recycling of solid wastes, safe collection and disposal of household hazardous waste, and composting of organic material. The hazardous waste program uses regulation and technical assistance to reduce the amount and toxicity of chemicals used and hazardous waste generated by businesses, and ensures that companies safely manage and dispose of the wastes that are generated. The regulation in that program includes the chemical weapons incinerator at the Umatilla Army Depot. The underground storage tank program ensures that commercial or home underground tanks containing petroleum products, heating oil, or other hazardous substances are not leaking and oversees the cleanup when leaks do occur. The environmental cleanup program ensures that sites contaminated by toxics from legacy practices are cleaned up and, where possible, are returned to productive use. Emergency management includes 24/7 spill response, marine and on land, and prevention and preparedness exercises to minimize the effects of spills, especially to water. In terms of the challenges and successes, ever since Oregon passed the Opportunity to Recycle Act in the mid-1980s, Oregon has been a leader in building recycling programs statewide. State law sets a statewide recovery rate of 50% by 2009, and we achieved 49.1% in 2005. A 2004 survey by BioCycle ranked Oregon as having the highest recycling rate in the nation. That said, Oregon benchmark number 83 shows that in spite of increased recycling, solid waste landfilled or incinerated has climbed steadily since 2001. Future challenges in this program are to retain Oregon's place as a recycling leader and to deal effectively with so-called e-waste, computers, cell phones, televisions, etc. Oregon benchmark number 84 shows that we continue to meet or exceed our target for getting toxic sites cleaned up. We are challenged, however, by legacy toxic pollution from abandoned mines, for which there is no significant state or federal funding for cleanup, although we have received some federal support to address hotspots. The chemical weapons stockpile at Umatilla continues to safely be destroyed, as indicated in key performance measure number 9. To date, 49% of the individual weapons have been destroyed, and 23% of the chemical agent has been destroyed. The target date for completion of the stockpile destruction is the end of April 2010. The fifth org chart in the stapled packet is our laboratory. DEQ's laboratory provides scientifically sound, timely, safe, and efficient monitoring, sample collection, and data analysis to assess the quality of Oregon's environment and to protect the health of our citizens. DEQ's lab and the Oregon Public Health Lab have been co-located and working closely together for many years. They will be moving this year to a modern, updated facility in Hillsboro. Both labs also play a role in homeland security in analyzing unknown chemicals for first responders and the FBI. The last org chart in the staple package is our agency management. This is the director's office, which provides staff to the Environmental Quality Commission and oversees the offices of government relations, communication and outreach, and enforcement. The Management Services Division ensures that DEQ satisfies the legal and administrative requirements relating to human resources, health and safety, budgeting, accounting, and information and business systems. That division also administers the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program. And finally, with regard to changes from 0507 and outstanding issues, I've included a budget summary fact sheet at the end of your packet. The biggest challenge facing the agency is to rebuild core programs. Since the 2001-03 biennium, general fund support for the agency's core programs has steadily eroded, reduced by about one-third since 0103. Federal funds have been flat or declining for several years, and fee payers now support the bulk of our programs, approximately 66%. Neither fee revenue nor federal revenue rolls up to cover inflation, so the agency is always behind in funding, and the problem has been exacerbated by the general fund cuts. Oregonians expect DEQ to be the guardian of our air, water, and land, and to provide citizens with clean, healthy environment. Our ability to do that has eroded dramatically over the past several years, which affects not only the environment, but the economic well-being of the state. The agency's priority for 07-09 is to work with you to restore resources so that we can do the job that the public expects us to do. And I welcome any questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Representative.
I have noticed now with several agencies that the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund is being cut, and we're having to cover that with general funds. At some point, it might be helpful, I would think, that we see this in aggregate instead of piece by piece by these different agency budgets. But just briefly, Stephanie, if you could share with us, in a more global sense, not just DEQ, but what exactly are these funds used for, and how important is it that we make sure that that's covered?
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, that's a great question, and you're absolutely correct that that fund has been cut. DEQ has not been a huge recipient of that funding source or, quite frankly, the Measure 66 lottery dollars. We do have about $4 million of the lottery dollars in our budget to support our work on total maximum daily loads. That's the setting of the pollutant loadings for water bodies throughout the state. A lot of our lab monitoring work. And Lisa, help me out. Do we still have PCSRF? I don't think we have any.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, the governor's recommended budget for 2007-09 does not include any PCSRF or Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund for this particular agency, partly because, or mainly because of the fact that we weren't expecting a significant amount of federal allocation.
And I think we've had up to 800,000 in the past. We've had a fairly extensive funds from that in the past.
Follow-up? Yes. Thank you, Mr. I'm not quite sure I understand what you said, and being kind of new here to the budget process, but the budget analysis here says that the governor's budget is recommending to replace $912,000 in change in other funds from PCSRF with general fund. So yeah. What you're saying is you're not getting the federal money, we're going to backfill it with general fund.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's correct.
And that's what I was asking was, I'd like to see that figure in aggregate, because we've seen this now with OWEB, we've seen it with ODA, we're seeing it with DEQ, and how many other agencies is this hit, and what's the total general fund cost going to be?
Get that. Also, I think Representative Burley, Representative Dinkfelter has told me that when OWEB comes up next, they will be happy to probably address that in more detail.
Additional questions?
I did have one, and it's kind of related. Throughout your budget, and particularly the LFO analysis, there's a note that you've noted of a decline in federal funds for programs and having to backfill those dollars with federal funds. Is it simply because the funding has been largely flat-funded, or is it because there has been an actual sharp decline? Because there are quite a number of of areas within the budget where we're having to backfill all at once. I mean, not slowly, but either we have the positions or we don't have the positions is what the question is becoming. So has there been a sharp decline or has it been flat?
Senator Devlin, members of the committee, that's an excellent question. Basically, the policy of the Bush administration has been to shift funding responsibility to states, and that is not necessarily true just in natural resources. However, for the last three budget cycles, EPA is one of, I think, three agencies that have had cuts every budget cycle to their agency. Most of those cuts they have chosen to pass on with instruction from the Office of Management and Budget to pass through to the states in the state grant allocation. So the states have carried an inordinate burden of the funding cuts that EPA has experienced. At the same time, there has been no reduction in the mandates that are coming forward in terms of, I mentioned, new regulations in air quality. We also have, as you will see when we discuss the budget, a very large request for funding of stormwater work. These are federal requirements. We are a delegated state. We have a policy decision to make in the state whether or not we want to continue to run programs on behalf of the federal government and whether or not we want to pay for them, because the federal government is not paying for them. Right now, our fee payers are paying for them to the tune of 66%, and one can debate from a policy perspective how high one wants that percentage to go.
Now, can I read into that response that in these cuts at the federal level, there a disproportionate amount of the cuts are going to the state-level agencies, and that the federal sort of federal operations are receiving only considerably less in terms of cuts?
Senator Devlin, you certainly may read that into my remarks. And the argument that the states have made pushing back is the EPA, if they have to take these cuts, ought to be taking it from somewhere else in their budget. We have suggested, as states, approximately, I think, 168 different contracts that EPA might take cuts from, as opposed to taking them out of state grants, that we are, in fact, their primary contractor, and they ought to be treating us as such. And I'm sure that I could probably have somebody from EPA come in here and talk to you about this, if you'd like that.
That might be beneficial.
Tell us how you really feel.
Any additional questions? Yes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I did want to touch also, Stephanie, on the underground injection control system and just maybe kind of update us on where that's at and what we're trying to avoid happening here through the proposed fee.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burley, this is a perfect segue because one of the potential outcomes of the funding problems and mandates is that we make the choice to give some of this work back to the federal government. Our agency had made a decision because of completely inadequate resources for underground injection control that we were, in fact, going to return it to the feds. Our governing commission asked us to please take a shot with the stakeholders at getting funding for it before we return it to the feds. The stakeholders, which are primarily municipal governments, also some people in the construction business, have stepped up to the plate. They have formed a group. They've come up with a fee proposal, which I'm sure you'll all be hearing about directly from the stakeholders. So with the support of this body, we are hopeful that we can keep that program and not give it back to the feds.
Questions. One final comment, Ms. Halleck. I receive, as every member receives, notices of your enforcement actions that occur within my district. Although only a couple of those have ever contacted me about your enforcement actions, I've always appreciated getting those because that means that when I did receive the calls, I knew what they were calling about. And I do think that's a very beneficial service to legislators to let them know what your enforcement actions are in their districts.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. And we really do try and get those to you in a timely manner so you do know what's going on.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One question, not for the director, just for you.
Is there someone knowledgeable, either a member or an LFO person, about the... At one point in the mid-90s, there was a law passed by Congress that basically said there can't be unfunded mandates. They have to have funding. I'd like to talk to someone who knows more about this. Is that repealed? How does that work?
I've been through several presentations on that law.
I'll visit with you sometime.
With NCSL, and the reality is it's very easy for Congress to overlook.
Okay. I just remember it's a campaign rhetoric. I've been 12 years.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one final comment, because I've been serving as the co-chair for the Energy and Environment Committee for NCSL for the past 2 years, and this is not a problem unique to Oregon. All the states are facing the same challenge, and it's not just state government, but local governments who are also faced with the challenges. There's the State Revolving Loan Fund that provides low-interest loans to municipalities to upgrade their wastewater treatment plants and water plants. It's a huge, huge shift of burden from the federal government to state and local government, and representing a city that now has the highest water and sewer rates in the entire state, and we're paying millions of dollars for the big pipe. I mean, it's something we really have to think about long-term, because the infrastructure costs, replacing old and failing infrastructure, especially for smaller local governments, is a huge, huge impact. And so it's something I think we really need to wrestle with over the next few years, because it's not going to get any better at this rate.
I almost was tempted to make a statement about vast infrastructure investments being made somewhere, but not here.
City of Portland's making them, believe me. We're paying for them.
We will move now on to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Mr. Filer. Actually, we are on schedule. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Byler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and I appreciate the opportunity today to give you a brief overview of our agency. You have as handouts two documents. One is a very brief nutshell of our agency, what we do, who we are, as well as on the other side of that page, a very brief overview of our programs with respect to our investments. I'll be speaking from the second handout, which is a series of PowerPoint slides that are in the form of a handout for you today. You know, in brief, in following up with the Department of Agriculture and DEQ, we offer a bit of a contrast. We're a very small agency, but I like to think of us as a small agency with a very big mission. And in very brief terms, what we do two things. In our core functions are to operate a grant program, and I'll go into that in some detail. We also provide important functions with respect to the family of state agencies in Oregon, with respect to monitoring and reporting of conservation actions that occur under the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. In terms of our grant program, it is an emphasis on what I refer to as voluntary cooperative conservation. We are an agency that invests in local communities with landowners across the state for grants that provide improvements to water quality and improvements to habitat that support fish and wildlife. That is the primary and core function for our agency, and I'll discuss how we're organized around that in momentarily. What's important for our program is that, and the way this is set up, is that it's very much a grassroots program. We are reliant upon landowners stepping up and wanting to do this work. And in order for them to do that, you know, as Representative Clem was saying, folks are busy out there. They're working 25 hours a day on just making a living. What we rely on to get our grants out on the ground are organizations such as local watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts and other local groups who do a lot of the legwork for these landowners. They're the ones who are knocking on the doors. They're the ones who live in the communities and are able to build the trust and relationships that provide opportunities for us to fund projects, restoration projects primarily, with these private landowners in different parts of the state. It's a system that works, and it works very well. our relevance to Oregonians, I believe, is that through our program we're able to make investments that improve the quality of life for Oregonians. Oregonians feel very strongly about their natural environment. It's a matter of pride for Oregonians across the state. And through our program, we're able to empower local landowners and local communities to control their own destiny with respect to these improvements of water quality and fish and wildlife habitat. A side benefit of that, an important side benefit of that, is that through this grant program, we are able to build trust and partnerships. We're able to build constructive alliances around natural resources issues, which is very helpful for everyone. It's helpful for us in terms of building a reputation and awareness so that we can partner with more landowners in different parts of the state. But it's also important for our sister state agencies who are critical to our functions and with respect to the technical assistance they provide and the relationships that they have and they need to have with landowners across the state. Moving into our program history, this is page 3 of the handout. It's the top slide. We have a pretty short history. We've been around. The legislature created OWEB in 1999 as a result of ballot measure 66, which was passed by 67% of voters in 1998. I think that integral to our history is our funding sources. We were born out of measure 66, and we are dependent upon receiving funding. And I'll talk a little bit about the different funding sources that we have, but I want to focus first on ballot measure 66. It is the main driver for our program. It funds habitat for habitat improvements for fish and wildlife as well as water quality. It's very broad with respect to its purposes in terms of improving watershed health. We are this is a constitutional amendment. And it has dedicated 15% of lottery revenues to two purposes. One is to state parks. The second is to watershed health restoration. We are the state agency that the legislature appointed to administer those funds. So we have 7.5% of the lottery funds that we are responsible for administering. Those lottery funds are split into two categories. 65%, this is under the Constitution as well, 65%. Sure. This one away.
Gap in the tape.
Okay. Is that working? That doesn't create a problem there. 65% under the Constitution, 65%, at least 65% of our lottery revenues are known as capital funds. And in our world at OWEB, those capital funds are meant for on the ground restoration, improvements to watershed habitat. And that is where the bulk of our funding goes. The remaining 35% we creatively refer to as non-capital funds, and those funds fund a important suite of activities that complement those capital restoration projects, like technical assistance, monitoring, watershed council support, and other actions that are part of the whole that makes the infrastructure work at a local level for us. The other piece that I mentioned on ballot measure 66 that's important for our program and what we do at OWEB is that ballot measure 66 has a 15-year window of time. It started in 1999 officially after the 98 vote, and it will end in the year 2014. However, the ballot measure also provides an opportunity for the voters of Oregon in 2014 to reauthorize ballot measure 66. And needless to say that in terms of how we operate, we're constantly thinking about the time frame that we have, and we want to make the best effort that we can and be most strategic and effective with our investments as possible, because there's an accounting that's coming up, and we're halfway through, essentially. We have about 7 years left on that time span. With respect to our monitoring and reporting functions, those are housed within responsibilities that we have under the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. The state legislature 10 years ago codified the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, and OWEB is a full participant in those activities. The Oregon Plan itself is premised on, it's less of a plan and more of a philosophy in governance, essentially. And there are four elements to the Oregon plan. I won't go into them in much detail other than to just recognize them for you, put them on your radar screen. One is that it's premised on the notion of coordinated agency actions. That given all the natural resources agencies that you're hearing from and with their separate missions, that we can do better in the state of Oregon if we have a high level of coordination between those agencies. And that is something that since the onset of the Oregon plan, we do coordinate better. We communicate on a regular basis under the umbrella of the Oregon plan. Second element of the Oregon plan is local voluntary watershed restoration. That is the key piece of what OWEB is working on with our grant program. Third, monitoring and reporting under the principle of if we're going to be making these investments in this effort to restore watersheds and recover listed species, salmon and steelhead species in particular, we need to know what we're doing. We need to pay attention to our actions and learn from them and analyze the work that's ongoing and make adjustments as we learn and review our work. So that's a very important piece of what we do. With respect to, OWEB in particular chairs an Oregon Plan monitoring team. It has 12 other agencies, and both state and federal, that sit on that group, and that provides an opportunity for us to be more strategic in terms of how we focus our energy toward monitoring. With respect to reporting, I hope you all received this. This is the biannual Oregon Plan report. OWEB produces this based on information that we collect over the years in terms of the conservation work that's happening. And this is a report to the legislature as well as the governor's office. We also report to the federal government with respect to the PCSRF funds, the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery funds that were discussed at the last presentation, which we'd be happy to address at the end of my presentation. The fourth piece of the Oregon plan is science oversight. The independent multidisciplinary science team is an independent science-based organization. OWEB funds that organization through pass-through that will be part of the discussion when we meet next down the line. And that group provides peer review and advice to state agencies and other Oregon plan partners in terms of the scientific basis for our decisions. As I mentioned, we're a small agency. We have 26 staff. Our functions key around operating our grant program and doing our monitoring program. We have a very simple structure. We have a director's office that has two people in it, my assistant and myself. And then we have four co-equal sections that operate. One is our grant program, which is the muscle of our agency, which also includes five field staff who are responsible for working the four corners of the state and working with our local folks. We also have a fiscal section, which does the numbers for us and makes sure that we're processing payments and that we're accountable in terms of our stewardship and fiduciary responsibilities for these funds. We have a monitoring and reporting section, and we also have an Oregon Plan coordination section that focuses also on policy issues for us. Our board, just briefly, is nearly as large as our agency. We have a 17-member board, and it's a very interesting board to work with. It's integrated in terms of its membership. We have board members who are members of the public at large. We have members who also sit on other boards and commissions of other state agencies, the Board of Agriculture, Board of Forestry, Fish and Wildlife Commission, Environmental Quality Commission, and I'm forgetting the other one, but it'll come to me. I'm sorry. We also have members of federal agencies who sit on our board, as well as a tribal representative. It's a wonderful amalgamation of natural resources expertise and experience that we have, and it's important for our program because our program, as it hits the ground, is helping achieve the goals of other programs, of other agencies. Our program is helping move forward some of the goals and objectives from the Department of Agriculture and their 10-10 plans. We're also moving forward on objectives under the water quality, objectives under DEQ. We're dealing with forestry issues. We're dealing with issues that water quantity issues at water resources. We're very much an organization that covers all the range of natural resources issues with our work. I would just point you to page 5, the second slide. There is a pie chart, and the reason I wanted to point that out to you is that it breaks out our funding sources for this biennium, and the overriding 77% of our funding is lottery funds. It didn't used to be that way. There used to be a larger slice of pie representing federal dollars, and that's the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds. That has been diminishing, and the most recent amount of federal funds that we had was cut in half compared to what we had received traditionally, and that is a trend that we're not sure will change over time, at least in the near term. We also receive a small amount of other funds some salmon plate license funds that are split between, those revenues are split between state parks and OWEB. Those go towards restoration projects for native Oregon fish that are have a connection to roads. On the next page, page 6 on the top, there's another pie chart for you, and the point that I want to make here is that we have a number of different types of grants that we offer. And I referenced earlier, we have capital and non-capital dollars, that 65% at least go to capital dollars. When you look at this pie chart, you'll see the 70% going to restoration. That is a capital expenditure for us. There's also our acquisition grants that are 9.7%. When you total those, you're looking at nearly 80% of our grants. Those are our capital grants. And 80% this biennium of our total funding is going towards capital purposes. That means we have about 20% of our program is going towards those non-capital purposes. That's while it's good news in the sense that we're getting a lot of dollars on the ground for restoration, it is an area of concern for us at OWEB and for our local partners that we have an effective balance between our capital and non-capital funds, because those technical assistance dollars and those monitoring dollars and those council support dollars create the local infrastructure and the expertise that we need to be able to do the work as well as we possibly can. On the same page, there's a map of the state, and the point here that I'd like to make is that this gives you a sense of the number of grants that we have awarded to date since 1999. These are restoration grants only. 970 grants for $79 million. What is important here is to recognize that when you look at the map of the state of Oregon, we have a shaded area and then we have an area that's non-shaded, and that shaded area represents publicly held lands. And if you look at the dots that represent our projects, most of those projects are happening on areas that are not shaded, meaning those are on private land. And that is a real value of our program, is that we're working with private landowners. We're getting projects on the ground with private landowners. In terms of successes and challenges, our biggest success, well, first of all, I'd say that our successes continue to be challenges. It's an ongoing work. But our biggest success, I believe, is the cooperative conservation, this local grassroots system that we have of getting projects on the ground. We're really a national leader and a model to other states in terms of what we've been able to achieve and how we're achieving it. I want to give you an example on the bottom of page 7 where we have a comparison between Oregon and the state of Washington in terms of conservation efforts that are happening. And what's important here to recognize is that there are a lot of states who are doing this kind of work, but there aren't very many states who are doing it at the level that Oregon and Washington are. What's interesting about the comparison between Oregon and Washington is that we have slightly different approaches. Washington's a little bit more centralized in terms of how they approach their business, and we're a little bit more grassroots in terms of how we do our work. But when you look at the numbers over a six-year period, Oregon has committed $117 million to a little under 2,000 projects on the ground, while Washington has committed $135 million to 496 projects. So a bit, that, I think, represents a little bit different philosophy in terms of how we approach our work. It also represents, in my view, how many landowners we're reaching. That's a lot of projects, and it's a lot of people that we're touching with these dollars. I think more importantly, though, is the second box there. When you see the outputs, the product that we're getting for this work is significant. And when you compare between the states, you'll see that we're opening up a lot more habitat for stream miles, for fish and for native fish and listed fish. We're getting a lot more work done on the uplands. We're getting more wetland work done. We're getting more logging roads treated so that they aren't adversely affecting water quality and fish habitat. And we're protecting more acres through acquisition and conservation easements. Our local folks are also being recognized nationally and internationally. And I won't go into this other than to point out on the top of page 8, our councils in the Walla Walla Basin and the Umpqua Basin have both received national recognition for their work. And a group of council and district and local partners in the Siuslaw have had international recognition for the work that they've been doing in terms of cooperative conservation. Some challenges that lie ahead. Progress on salmon recovery. We're working closely with the Department of Fish and Wildlife and other agencies on completing salmon recovery plans in the different ecological units the federal government has designated across the state. And that is a something that we hope to have those completed within the next year or so. I think by the end of this calendar year, OLWEB will play a critical role in implementing the priorities established under those plans. The one plan that is most exciting to me is on the north coast with the coho, and that's an area where through changes in management practices, through good monitoring and good information, and through work done through these local groups who are doing conservation work, the federal government 2 years ago decided to not list the coho. And we've been busy working among our sister state agencies to develop a conservation plan because having a no list is not enough for us. I think that it doesn't mean our work is done. We're putting this plan together, which will be adopted by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, I believe, in March, that will provide a roadmap for us and the folks locally in that area along the north coast to rebuild those stocks. Ultimately so that we can have sustainable commercial and recreational harvest, which will be a benefit not only in terms of the habitat values that we'll achieve if we make those goals, but also in terms of the economic benefits for the local community. Two other pieces that are ongoing challenges for us and of interest to us is that our investments have a positive impact on the local economy for communities. We had a survey or a study done a few years back that found that about 80% of our grants, that our grant awards, stay in the local community, and that means they're going to goods and services and jobs and labor that are local. And when you look at what we will do by the end of this biennium, we'll have committed $50 million just this biennium to local grants. That means $40 million is staying local in the area where those grants are awarded. And that's a big deal, especially in the rural communities around the state. That is a big deal. And it's important to us that those dollars stay there as well. And one last point in terms of successes and challenges, we're constantly looking for ways to improve our processes with our grantees. We know that chasing grant dollars is not a fun activity, and it can be laborious, and we're always looking for ways to streamline our process. This biennium, we were able to put together a database and a web-based access of our grant system. This is useful for our grantees. They're able to access and monitor and administer their grants in a way that they have easier access to understand their deadlines that they have and responsibilities they have under their grants. And forecasting into the future, we hope to have online grant capability in the near term, and also have our data in terms of conservation activities have a web-based interface so that our grantees and other folks who be interested in what's happening on the ground will be able to get onto the internet and be able to access that data easily. As a wrap-up, just want to emphasize for us that the unique nature of Measure 66 really focuses our efforts. The fact that we're halfway through the 15-year window of time that we have gives us a sense of urgency. It gives us a sense of that we really want to do the best that we can with the time that we have. that we want to maximize this opportunity. What we have is very special. This is a unique opportunity in the state of Oregon. It's a unique opportunity, really, in the nation in terms of being able to do work that's above and beyond the regulatory baseline. And it's also a way, the way of doing it is I think, it also makes it very special because it's very much community-based. We're doing it in a way, we want to ultimately do this in a way where communities are engaged and they want to make this happen. And I think that that's the best long, in terms of having healthy watersheds, if we can get communities to be engaged, if we can have them active and participating, I think that's the strongest ingredient for success in the long term for natural resources management for the state. Our key issue is finding that effective balance between our capital and non-capital dollars so that we can put our best foot forward over the next 7 years as we go towards 2014. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll close and we'll be happy to address any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, with the lottery budget, lottery funds increasing at putting $1 billion into the general fund now every biennium. You have undoubtedly benefited because you have 7.5% of those lottery funds. So does that gain in funds offset the loss that you suffered through the salmon recovery funds as far as your overall budget?
Yeah, Chair Devlin, Representative Garrard, that's a very good question. And I'd say that under the governor's recommended budget, we'd be in a very good place. And I know that's a starting point and not a finishing point, but there has been an uptick in the Measure 66 funds, both in terms of the capital and the non-capital, which is very important for us. We don't know the concern that we have now is that we don't know whether the estimate of federal funds, that there is a federal fund estimate in our budget for these specific salmon funds. And we don't know whether that will be met in reality when Congress passes the what we expect to be a continuing resolution for the federal fiscal year 07. And that could create a gap in our budget. And principally, we've relied on these federal salmon dollars for non-capital purposes, for the technical assistance, watershed council support, monitoring work. And that continues to be our challenge. And I guess one way to frame it for us, at OWEB at least, these increasing lottery dollars are a fantastic opportunity for us, and our capital dollars continue to increase at a significant level. It's keeping that balance so that the non-capital dollars have an effective balance between those capital funds that has been a continuing challenge for us.
You do a great job at Climate, by the way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, would you like me to go into a little bit more in detail on the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds? I can give you more detail down the line, but I can cast back. I do have some numbers from this current biennium in terms of the allocation of those federal salmon dollars. They went to OWEB. They were about $15 million total. I'll certainly look at Paul to see if I'm heading in the wrong direction here, but about $15 million total of federal salmon funds, and those were split roughly in half between OWEB and other agencies, and the two other agencies that received those funds were DEQ at a little over $800,000 and the Fish and Wildlife Department, which received about a little under $6 million. And under the current recommended budget by the governor, I don't think any agency other than OWEB is proposed to have the federal salmon funds.
Chair, yeah, I didn't ask the question because while Tom was talking, read the budget analysis here, and it does state that very clearly in here where what's going on. So my question was answered. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Just to follow up to that, the decline at the federal level, Was that an anticipated decline, or?
Chair Devlin, I guess the answer is yes, in the sense that we're seeing budgets, federal pots of money across the board struggle. The challenge that we've had is that these federal salmon dollars are distributed to Alaska, Washington, Idaho, California, Oregon, and the Northwest tribes. and it's not a fair distribution between states. The state of Alaska and the state of Washington take the lion's share of the funding. And what's happened in the past is that there's been anywhere from $80 to $100 million available of those funds in total. Alaska and Washington have taken about anywhere from $20 to $25 million apiece. But this last fiscal year, that number was reduced to about $67 million. Well, Washington and Alaska maintained the status quo. They still received about $20 to $25 million apiece. Everyone else got cut back significantly.
Is it NOAA Fisheries that makes those allocations?
Chair Devlin, Representative Burley, no. It's the Congress that determines that allocation.
I think, unfortunately, Representative Burley, and you see lots of examples of this in other areas. It's who has the seniority and...
on the appropriations. Mm-hmm.
Who's on the appropriation? Yes, Representative Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to at least... I serve on both Ag and Natural Resources and this committee, as does a couple of us do. And these are more policy things, I know. But there are some things I know that sometimes happen with the federal government that if we can be advocates to our members, a congressional delegation... For example, I recall being at an early Watershed Council meeting with Senator Wyden when I worked for him, and the Watershed Council, including, I think it was Senator Messerly, former Senator Messerly, said, you know, they have these rules that we can't work with federal dollars on private lands. At some time they made them because people were giving their friends money or whatever the contracts were about way back when. We rewrote the laws on a napkin, and it coincidentally worked out that about a month later, we were able to actually get the law passed. And I think they're called watershed enhancement agreements, where you can make an agreement, the state and a watershed council can make an agreement with the BLM secretary that says, yes, you can spend money on a private land because that's where the fish kill is occurring. And, I mean, that came out of an idea in Coos Bay that, you know, Senator Wyden, in this case, along with a Republican senator, went and got the law changed in a month. So the more that we can help you, I know the money thing is a different issue with seniority and all that, but the non-financial barriers, then I know I think other members would like to talk to Congress about those things.
Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. Tomorrow, committee, we will have the Department of Forestry, the Parks and Recreation Department, and the Marine Corps. And if there's nothing else, we may adjourn.